Hey everybody, welcome to New World Pictures Podcast bonus episode interview. I'm Ryan, with me as always is Mark.
Hello there, happy to be here.
And Erica.
Bonus episode.
That's right, we got a bonus episode for Ha-Ha-August. That's right, we're going to step back and talk about a movie we've already discussed, Rock and Roll High School. But we got a great interview lined up. We got the director of Rock and Roll High School, we have Alan Arkish. We have editor, who was an assistant editor and a PA, Mark Helfrich, who has gone on to have a very long and illustrious career as an editor. He edited Predator. He edited Rambo First Blood Part 2. He edited all the Rush Hours. He edited the recent Jumanji movies, a very long career. But this is where he got his start, and he talks about that in the interview. But also we have author Stephen Armstrong, who wrote the book I Want You Around, The Ramones and the Making of Rock and Roll High School, which is an excellent book, and is, if you wanted to know anything about Rock and Roll High School, this is the book. So glad that we got to talk to him. He's also written a couple books that I use constantly. He wrote two volumes of Roger Corman's New World Pictures, An Oral History. And I think there's a third volume. I'm not 100%. We don't get to talk about it, but we talk about a bunch of things. And of course, it's just me. I can't wait for you guys to hear this episode because this is just, it's just
I'm
me.
I'm excited to hear this. I want to say that I was extremely disappointed that I wasn't able to be a part of this.
Sure.
Certainly, we are incredibly grateful for everyone for giving us time to talk about this movie. It's a super exciting movie for us to talk about. It's one that I think we all really enjoyed. Definitely disappointed that I wasn't able to be a part of this discussion.
Yeah, just one of those things with scheduling. We were trying to schedule, we couldn't get Mark or Erica, so it was just me flying solo. And I think you might hear a little bit of me being a bit nervous, being the only person dealing with it. I think it's a really good interview. It's really very insightful, very interesting. We go through a lot of the history, the different scripts. We go into a little bit about Get Crazy, which is one of Alan Arkish's follow-ups, and got a recent Blu-ray from Kino Lorber. And so we sort of talk about that, about the production on that. Really, really excited for this, for everybody to hear it, and really grateful to all involved, as Mark said, especially Stephen, who helped put all this together. So here I am talking to Alan Arkish, Mark Helfrich, and Stephen Armstrong. And so I wanted to ask you, starting with you, Stephen, because this is one of several New World books you've written now, the other two of which I have as well. And I just wanted to ask, what started your interest in New World?
When I was kid, we lived in the Washington, D.C. area and didn't have cable TV. Since those were the days of ABC, NBC, CBS, and a couple of independent stations. And my grandmother, on the other hand, had cable TV, had HBO. And it was always kind of a joy to go up to her house and watch TV. And I remember seeing Saturday the 14th. And right there in my grandmother's house. And I want to say that the Dirk Benedict story that Gail Ann Hurd put together, was it Georgia Road? Is that it, Alan?
Georgia Peaches.
Georgia Peaches, yeah. Georgia Peaches.
AKA Follow That Car.
Yeah, boy, you know it better than I do. And so I saw that. And so my introduction to New World was through the deals that Roger and Barbara Boyle secured with the cable companies. And then after that, I went through a period of, well, my father got HBO in our house. He would do these trial subscriptions, and then eventually he'd always get mad at the cable company and cancel it. But when I was down, I would go sneak and watch TV shows down in the basement. One of them was Death Race 2000, and the other was Eating Raoul, which is not a New World picture, but it features a bunch of people who
could have been
Roger. Yeah,
I believe it's called New World Adjacent. It's New World Adjacent.
Yeah. like the Howling. Yeah. And and saw that. So, you know, imagine a 13-year-old seeing Eating Raoul. It was kind of head changing. And then I was a skate rat back then. That's how I found alternative music through Lou Reed, but I found punk through the skateboard scene. This was in the first half of the 80s. And that's when MTV was having its Sunday night broadcasts of midnight movies and underground films, and Rock and Roll High School was one of them. And a buddy of mine named Adam said, you got to see this film if you like the Ramones. And we'd been listening to the soundtrack album. And, you know, I snuck down 9 o'clock on a Sunday night. Parents are in bed, sister's asleep. And I'm watching Rock and Roll High School. And I was like, it's one of those few times in life when a movie really, really connected with me, sort of almost threw me to the ground emotionally. And I was like, yeah, this is what I'm about. Not blowing up schools, but being, you know, sort of anti-establishmentarian in my outlook and really liking rock and roll. And I became a defiant high schooler after watching that film. Barely graduated from high school, as a matter of fact. But thanks, Alan, for corrupting me. but even so, it's a part of it is Alan's directing is what got to me. It's the performances in the film. It's the editing in the film. It's the music. And I think that happened to me with the Wild Bunch. I saw that. It was a movie, you know, there's no turning back after this. A Fritz Lang picture called The Big Heat and then Rock and Roll High School. Those are the movies that are we allowed to swear on this show at all?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. I call them goddamn movies. It's just like, goddamn, what a movie. And that's how it was for me when I was 14 years old. And that was the expurgated version where you don't have the drug humor and you don't have the sexy scene with the I want you around portion, as Joe Dante points out so often, that the MTV version was quite compromised, but it's such potent stuff. It worked for me.
And Alan, what was your first New World Pictures? I know you started working for them around 1974. So
yeah,
but you were obviously aware of them before that.
I guess I was aware of them when Jonathan got hired to do Night Call Nurses. So Jonathan Kaplan, myself, and John Davison went to film school together, along with Jamie Anderson, who shot some of our movies, and Danny Opatashu, who wrote Hollywood Boulevard and Get Crazy. So we were all at NYU together, and we also all worked at the Fillmore East together. So when I was in England doing Light Show in 72, I guess, Jonathan got hired to make Night Call Nurses. So I came home in 73. And so then I met with John at some point in the summer of 73 or in the spring. John was back in New York and he was telling me about what he was doing. And I guess they had already started student teachers. And so John was working as Roger's assistant at some point. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, you know, nothing's going to happen here in New York. Come out to LA and do like we did, which is basically just wait for a job opening. And so that's what I did. I left for, I drove a cab and saved up about $400 and then left for LA in October 3rd or 4th, 1973.
Mm. And you got some money working on some small films, sort of like industrial films while you
were. Yes, I was a grip. I'm sorry, a gaffer on a dental film. I got to say, my skills are underused in that area. You know,
you had a calling there almost.
I had a calling.
You denied it, really.
Yeah.
It was a career you turned down.
Somehow or other, I got a job on one of these companies that made films for the Army. You know? So I did that for a while, and I wrote a treatment, and I had meetings about directing Candy Stripe Nurses, but I didn't get that job. And then around March, almost, you know, to the date, John asked me if I had moved out to Jonathan Kaplan's garage. I was living in Jonathan Kaplan's garage on a foam mattress. So we're talking, you know, basic subsistence living. And
sure.
You know, $4 a day on food. And so John had started with Joe. Joe had just started working at New World, and it was overwhelming, the amount of work, when they realized that they were going to take all this on. And they needed someone also to, while Joe was editing, to do what assistant editors do and what Teamsters do. And so that's what I did. And so.
So to back up, you said you tried to get the direction job for Candy Stripe Nurses?
Correct. Yeah. And I'm glad I didn't get it. Yeah, Alan Holub got it.
Alan Holub. That was so they did. They did hire an Alan.
Yeah.
But you did end up working on doing the trailer, right?
Yes. When I started working with Joe, he was working on Candy Stripe Nurses, the TV spots for Cries and Whispers, and the trailers and TV spots for Cage Heat.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was three movies that really go together. Well,
you know, right, that's like, right.
They're highly curated. Right. And so my first job was going over to the Cage Heat editing room and pulling some music for the trailer. And so I watched my first, I think I'd seen Night Call Nurses and Student Teachers, but I watched Cage Heat on the Moviola in the wrong order because whatever reels were available, they handed to me. And that meant it was a black and white version because Roger did no color dailies. So I watched right. Cage Heat, and while I was watching it, I met Jonathan Demme. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So, Mark, I was just asking, what was your first New World movie? Was it actually Rock and Roll High School?
That was the first movie that I worked on, yes.
For sure.
The first New World picture that I remember seeing was Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay.
And I saw that in Madison, Wisconsin, where I was going to school. And
at a drive-in or campus?
I think it was on campus.
So you saw it in 16?
Yeah, yeah, in all its glory.
Yeah, so by the way, just for the people who are keeping up with this stuff, if you see the 16-millimeter version, it set the world record for most visible microphones. as Joe and I were watching the 16 and counting 43 microphones in the shots.
Well, I had never seen anything like it. I mean, it was
of course not.
Yeah. I'd never seen so many microphones.
It's an incredible display of microphones.
Yeah, yeah. It was breaking the sound wall. You know?
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw a boom in a film. That was a Cassavetes film, I think. And I thought, oh, wow, what a mistake. But yeah, Hollywood Boulevard really set a new record.
Yeah.
But I love that film. I thought it was so zany. I thought it was hilarious and so action-packed and crazy. So that I was a big fan of that film. And I had also seen this movie called the Movie Orgy. The Schlitz Movie Orgy, which Joe Dante put together with. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw all 6 or 7 hours of it while drinking beer from Schlitz. And it was insane. Loved it. So those are that wasn't a New World picture, but again, New World adjacent.
Sure, sure. I love the, going back to you, Stephen, some of the descriptions, one of the descriptions that I love is John Davison's description in your first volume of New World Pictures and Oral History, where he talks about how New World distributed their movies. But I think you summarize it even better here in I Want You Around, in that you talk about the sort of follow the sun theory of distribution, where it sort of starts in the South and sort of follows the sun mm-hmm. going up north, which I think is such a, is just crystallized to me how they did their whole distribution.
Right. Yeah. So, which explains why Rock and Roll High School failed, because on the weekend that we opened in the South at the drive-ins, it rained. So our whole cycle of following the sun was off.
Didn't it start like initially in Texas? Didn't it start?
Yes, I'm kidding. Yeah. It stormed and the Pearl River overflowed. And so that killed Texas. And as Johnny Ramone put it so succinctly, in New Mexico, the Ramones sold 137 fucking albums. So every time. So that makes me think there's only 137 people like the Ramones. Why the fuck did you open it in New Mexico? That's a good quote.
Yeah. it brings up another topic which from the book that I think is interesting too, because Frank Moreno, who had done, it was worked for New World for a long time, of course, was instrumental a little bit in getting a lot of the foreign films that New World would release. But he was very, I never knew this until I read the book, very much against Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah.
And adamantly against it, even when it would show signs of success, was still against it. That has got to be so difficult to deal with.
you know, Frank was in charge of distribution, but he was not consulted ever by us about trailers. That was John Davison, and then we would show him to Roger. So I think that Frank just, he never came to the editing room. He kind of ignored us, you know, and we just did, which would have been, which was odd, I guess, to him because he was the head of film distribution.
Right.
And on the night, he wasn't pleased about the movie. And then on the night of the preview, after was, you know, our meeting out on the sidewalk, the classic New World meeting, he really tried to sink the movie.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a defining moment in my life, you know.
Did you have any idea that he was not into the movie before then, or was it just at that?
I guess I did, you know, but not much. I never, and the preview was such an odd, were you there, Mark?
I think I was, yeah. All the punks were there. It was great.
That was right, yeah.
Yeah, it was a fantastic preview.
The World Theater, which normally would have like three movies for a dollar and a half. And so that night they had four.
And really? Okay.
So including the preview. And so it's on a part of Hollywood Boulevard that's desolate at best. And about four or five blocks away was a rundown hotel that the punks called Disgraceland. And that's where the punk scene all lived, the Go-Go's, all these people lived in that place, and they played at a club called The Mask. And I knew them from I just knew that area and knew the punk clubs. And so they had heard there's a preview and four movies for a dollar and a half. And so they just showed up to see four movies for that. And
that was the best 37 and a half cents they spent.
It absolutely was. And as one of them put it in the bathroom while I was peeing, some friend says, "What do you think?" And he says, "Not bad four movies for a buck and a half," you know. So that was our first good review. And
right there in the toilet, right there in the bathroom.
They just come in, and then all of a sudden the movie starts and they see the titles and the Ramones song, and they went crazy and they loved the movie. And
did it play last of the four?
It played in a cycle. I don't think there was a last. I think the last was Dawn. That was a theater.
And it played with the Who movie, right?
No, it played with
Nashville Girl.
Nashville Girl. Thank God it's Friday. And I think Saturday Night Fever. I don't think it was Grease.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was the show. And they loved it. And Paul Bartel got caught by Roger sneaking into the theater. So Frank Moreno says, "You're packing the house." And Paul. And he was so shocked by the applause. And then the people waved to me going out because I knew them from clubs. He claimed that I had packed the house. And that he didn't understand the Ramones, and there's too much of them, and it's practically a commercial for the Ramones, and we got to cut out the middle of every single Ramones song because they're annoying and so forth. And then he said the scene in the bedroom with the girls, where they're talking about Joey eating pizza and everything, that scene had to go. And because it was, you know, boring. And so I had to dig in my heels and basically plead for the rest of my life.
let's back up a little bit, because I think what's interesting about Rock and Roll High School is I had never heard of, and I knew a little bit about the fact that it was girls' gym initially and then disco high, but the script phases of this, which Stephen does such a great job of going through in his book. I didn't realize there was a whole phase of it be calling California Girls. Like, it went through many iterations, which typically at New World, they didn't do this many versions of a script as far as.
Yeah, remind me of the California Girls, Stephen.
Okay. And I got that from Joe McBride when I was going through some paperwork with the Writers Guild that he had preserved. And but the script had that working title. Chuck Griffith was working on it for a while. Joe worked on it, and then Paul when he read it, didn't think it was funny enough. That's always been my understanding. And you didn't think it was funny enough. And John Davison didn't think it was funny enough. And hence it was taken back
from
Joe.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. When Joe and I did the outline, it came out of two things. One was a treatment I had written called Heavy Metal Kids, which nobody really saw. And Joe and I had written many outlines in the car driving around, one of which was about a Maoist teacher at a high school. I think it might have been called, you know, Communist Teachers or something. But in any case, that one didn't go anywhere.
Sure.
But I have the outline. Joe drew a picture of her, and she's wearing a bikini and a Mao cap. And that became ultimately Girls Gym. And that's what was read. That was what was told to Francis Dole and then became, you know, typed up and then was handed to Joe McBride. And so Joe really put in quite a bit of work on it. And it was
he removed the Mao caps.
Without the Mao cap. And also without the clothes, because Mike Fennell and I had to figure out a way to find a gym and find high school looking girls that would do nude gymnastics, and that the gymnastics had to look good enough to believe that they could win the local championship. So
was the initial conceit was like, it was
exactly
a girls gym. It was just, sort of like the nurses movies. It was going to be a three girls story. And nude gymnastics. That was kind of a caveat from Corman.
That was going to be on the poster, and that's what it was about. And it's only till last year or so that I found out a way to make it. So, Mark, if you're interested, I think we could do it totally AI.
I think it sounds ripe for the picking.
Yeah,
for me,
there is not a woman on the planet with a SAG card who's going to do new gymnastics, which we found out. And there was no high school that would let us do it. And even though we changed the script for Rock and Roll High School, when we searched for high school, this was massive, but we were stuck with it. And it was only when Joe came up with the idea for the students going on strike and then ultimately blowing up the high school, which I didn't think was funny and was against. And about a week or two later, I kept thinking, it's so stuck in my mind that I thought it was right. So then John and I'm not sure if Joe was there maybe, and Joe McBride and me went and spoke to Roger about this major change in it. And Roger listened. I said, at the end, the students blow up the high school, et cetera. And I said, I think that'll be a great trailer, and great on the poster. And he said, yes, let's do that. I said, does that mean we can get rid of the new gymnastics? Because that's when we explained why we couldn't do it. You always have to wait till the right moment. And he goes, yeah,
sure.
Forget the new gymnastics. So
blowing up a high school wasn't part of your fantasy back in New Jersey, Alan?
No. The fantasy ended with the final song of the Yardbirds set. It was the rock and roll. It was the races in the hallways of go-karts and motorcycles. This is going to really sound like I'm a lunatic. I would keep track of these races every class and try to remember who was in first place. And if I got called on in class, I was like, oh, shit, I got to stop the race.
So with all these script iterations, did that make you kind of nervous about the project? Because, again, I don't know of many, and maybe Stephen knows better, knows of a project, but I haven't come across one in the Corman New World days that had that many different scripts. It was an unusual situation.
It was a very unusual situation because, unlike almost every other New World picture, when the people came to New World, they came and they did one movie, maybe two, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And Joe and I essentially started in March of 74. So we were on the staff, so to speak.
Right.
So we had a constant interplay with Roger. And as the company grew, John, Joe, and I kept up doing, Jesus, we did so many different jobs. Oh, we were the post, what a studio would have for post-production is what we did. Plus cutting the trailers, plus watching the movies with him, plus going to see the foreign movies, and him never really having to do much explanation to us about who Fellini was, you know?
Right.
So
right.
all that right. was him giving us quick notes and then coming back and seeing a cut and giving us more notes. So we, and then when we did Hollywood Boulevard, I think he was truly surprised about how it turned out. As a matter of fact, Mark, when we had that night in honor of Rock and Roll High School at the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Roger was sitting on the couch next to me. We're running clips of New World Pictures. We ran the battle scene from Hollywood Boulevard, the Philippine War sequence with Mary firing the guns and the ride of the Valkyries. And when it's over, Roger turns to me and goes, "It's very well cut." As if he was Great. Giving me more notes. You know? It was like the highest compliment that it held up.
Right, right.
And he watched a cut of it, and there's a line in the movies. You see the shirt mod $50 from JG or whatever his name was, the producer, of the film, within the film. And we cut it out of the next cut. And then Roger said, "Where's the producer?" I said, "Well, we cut it out. We didn't think it contributed price." He earned that shirt. He's doing a good job. He deserves to be in the movie with that shirt. Okay, you know.
Rock and Roll High School also comes from another element of New World Pictures that I was not quite aware of. I knew, of course, that you'd worked on Death Sport and you had shot right. the other part of that album, but I didn't realize that in agreeing to do Death Sport, you were like, "Hey, Roger, how about I also do this high school movie?" And he was like, "If you do Death Sport, you can do your high school movie."
Yeah, that's almost what it was. Is that we were still developing Girls Gym, and when he asked me to put aside, he was pretty desperate because we had watched Death Sport; it was a mess. And it didn't even have the right screen direction. I mean, really, you know. And so, and it had, you know, of course, what all of us know is the number one sin in a New World Picture is that it had no action. So, yeah, you're banished to the ninth circle of hell for that. And so he called me, he says, "I want to talk to you." You know, so he called me up on the phone and he said, "You know, I really, you've got to put down, I'm sorry, Alan, but I need you to do this, and we'll put aside the development of your high school movie, you know." And then he said, "And if you know, when you get done with this, we'll go right back to it. And why don't you add music to it? Because I know you really want to." And I think somewhere around there is where he decided to call it Disco High, you know, while I was doing that. So this has got to be the winter, late 78.
Okay. Yeah. You know. Roger's idea was Disco High, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, it took a lot of for everybody to make this movie and to get this movie made. It took a lot of individuals just sort of pushing and trying to get their shot. And that includes you, Mark, because the way you get into this movie, I think, is fascinating, the way you got involved. Can you tell us how you got involved in Rock and Roll High School?
Well, briefly, I had just moved to Hollywood in hopes of breaking into the film business. But I didn't know anybody here. I knew one guy. He was the projectionist in the theater that I worked in when I was 15 years old. And he was now living here in LA. So I was sleeping on his couch and clueless as to how to go about breaking in. And long story short, I read in Variety that in films in the future, the column of that, that John Landis was going to do a movie called Incredible Shrinking Woman. So right. I thought, all right, I know that he worked with the Zuckers. The Zuckers came from Madison, Wisconsin, and that's where I just came from. So I've got something in common. I got something to talk to him about. I'll give John Landis a call. So that's what I did. I called the studio. I asked for John Landis. They put me through to the secretary. And now this phone call was an act of desperation by this point. I'd been here in Hollywood for 3 months with no leads, nothing, just eating chocolate donuts because they were so cheap. And that was my whole diet. So when I got on the phone with the secretary to John, she said, "What's this in regards to?" And I said, trivia, put me through to John. I don't know where that came from, but the phone went click. And the next thing I know, John Landis is on the phone talking to me. And he just so happened to be doing nothing at the time. So he was really nice. And we talked about film and all comedy. And finally he said, I don't have any positions on this film, but if I were you, I'd call Roger Corman's New World Pictures. So I'm writing down Roger Corman's New World Pictures. Okay. And I thanked him. I looked up the phone number for New World. I called, I asked to speak to Roger, and I'm sorry, he's not available. So I called back the next day, same thing. I'm sorry, he's out of town. Called back the next day, and his secretary finally said, "What's this in regards to?" And I said, "His next film." So she said, "You mean Rock and Roll High School?" And I said, "Yes."
And she said, "That sounds good."
She said, the production phone number for that is this. So I wrote that down and I called that number and Alan picked up the phone. Uh-huh. And I said, "Hi, I'm Mark Helfrich and John Landis told me to call you." And Alan said, "He did. Well, you better get down here." I don't know, Alan, how did you know John? Did you know John by that point?
This is going to be good. Okay. So when I was working for New World, right at that time, and I was doing Hollywood Boulevard or something like that, the script supervisor had done Animal House. And that was Catherine Wooten, whose nickname was Boots. Okay. So Boots did that. And Boots also worked on Grand Theft Auto and a couple other things. And so I kind of dated Boots for a while. And then about 19, well, this follows it. So it's a side trip. Okay. So after I finished Rock and Roll High School, I had showed John Rock and Roll High School. And so I knew him before that through Sean Daniel, who was part of these young executives working at Universal that came in and did Animal House and Coal Miner's Daughter and all of this. And so they were friendly with us because we were young people too. And so John says to me, calls me up and says, "Oh, it's my birthday party tonight. Will you come and to my birthday party? And you know that documentary, Hollywood's Wild Angel?" I said, yeah. He says, "Do you have a print of it?" And I said, "Well, I think Joe's got one." And he says, "Can you bring it and run it at the party?" So this is like 1979 in January. So I find the print and I bring it over to the party. We're running it. And there's a scene in the – have you seen it? It's parts of it are in Corman's World. There's a scene in it where I'm out in the desert. My hair is sticking out wildly and I'm wearing these sunglasses. I'm describing how we're going to wreck the shit out of this house and drive a car through it, And I am like out of my skull because I'm under the sun and we're, And I hear a woman behind me say, "Oh, he's cute," not knowing that I'm sitting in front of her, right? She just says, "Oh, that guy's cute." And when the lights go up, I turn around and introduce myself. And to this very day, she's right downstairs in my house and we got married.
Wow.
That's how I met Joanne.
Amazing.
But anyway, so I knew Landis through Catherine Wooten. And he came and he looked at a cut of Rock and Roll High School and he gave us a couple of notes, And so that's how I knew, Landis. And it was the kind of thing where at that point, LA, a lot of us would go to the same revival houses to watch movies. So you'd see each other and certainly to the LA County Museum on weekends, because that was like a place where you could see really rare movies and the movie stars would come and so forth. So we were all such fanatic film buffs. And maybe John also had borrowed a couple of Joe's prints and things like that.
Alan, I always wondered what did John Landis think of the poster that Bill Stout did for Rock and Roll High School, given that it was pretty dang derivative of the Animal House. Actually, it was under Roger's orders that he make it look like the Animal House.
Well, I think you just about summarized it. He never said he was mad or anything, but he, was aware.
But they look good side by side on the wall.
Yeah.
But anyway, so when Alan told me to come down, I didn't have a car. I had $600 left to my name, but I got on the bus. I went down to the production office. I met with Mike Fennell, and his first question was, "Do you have a car?" And I lied and I said, "I have a van." He said, "You have a van? You're hired." Because I knew that there was a van for sale across the street from the couch I was sleeping on for $600. So I got back on the bus hoping that van was still for sale. I bought it, and that's how I became a PA on Rock and Roll High School.
When did you transition into getting into the editing room?
On that, well, during production, I was the guy who did everything, anything and everything. So I would pick up the Ramones from the Tropicana and take them to the set and take them back. I would pick up 100 school chairs from one place and bring it to the site that we're shooting. I would go get lunches. I would do everything, including I was the guy who would take the exposed negative to the lab at night and bring the work picture from the lab to the editing room. So I got to know Kent Beta, the assistant editor on that, and Larry Bach and Gail Werben, the editors, because I would drop off the film every day to them. So as soon as production wrapped, I didn't have a job. So I just hung out in the editing room. They had two editors and one assistant. I could do the math. You need another assistant. So I became an assistant editor, and I worked for free for about a month until I approached Mike again and said, "Hey, I'm working every day. You need me. I think you should pay me." And he agreed. I got $100 a week. So now, that was a rate. That was a raise over $75 a week, which I was getting on as a PA.
And, you know, in the mafia, that's called making your bones. So,
and then you made your bones. You continued on into Lady in Red, right?
I was I became the assistant editor on Lady in Red, which Larry Bach cut as well.
Oh, so did you just move from Rock and Roll High School right into that?
Yeah, that was my last trailer I cut for New World.
Yeah, did you still worked at New World, right, Alan, after Rock and Roll High School?
Yeah.
You were done with it?
It was, I felt I had to because of the way things were going with how it was distributed. So I had to have access and I needed money, you know. And
sure.
So I used that excuse to constantly go up to New World offices and go down in the distribution part where, even though Moreno didn't like the picture, everyone else did. And they liked me. I'd been around. See, that's the other part of what I was saying is that being there for so long, I was trusted. So if we said we want to do something different than what Roger wanted, he would actually listen and consider it because he knew we would never do something stupid, you know. And so that's why when I explained to him the difference between disco and punk rock, he understood that and he trusted me because it was something he didn't know as much about. And he seemed like I was pretty passionate, you know, and jumping up and down on his couch. So
it was an interesting movie too, for the slate even in that year. I have the New World Pictures for 1979, Autumn Sonata.
Right.
From Francis Truffaut that year. St. Jack, of course, from
which was the Truffaut movie that year was
Love on the Run and Green Room, right?
Yep. Wow.
Exactly. And The Brood and Up from the Depths, which then there's Rock and Roll High School, and also Swim Team, which never got made.
No.
And The Bees and a re-release of Death Sport with Death Race 2000. And then, of course, Lady in Red.
And The Brood was, I think we got, the MPAA did not like that at all. So we had to, I remember us having to bring it back and show it to them without the, I think it was the baby stuff. And then as soon as they said yes, we put the baby stuff back in.
So. Which was typical of Corman, right? To take
put it right back in.
Yeah.
That year too, they had Star Crash came out and also The Prize Fighter, too. That's right. That was what my source. Yeah. And the kids are all right. Yeah. Hey, can I slip in something really quickly? Is that when I was talking about Joe McBride and the California Girls script 20 minutes ago, I said that John Davison didn't think it was funny. It was Mike Fennell. I was editing something that John gave me. And that's why his name is in my head right now.
That makes sense. For the record.
Yeah.
And so it was called California Girls when Joe McBride wrote it for a while.
Yeah. That's what Joe, you know, I've been interviewing Joe since the aughts, I guess they call it. And, he had never mentioned that before and then sent me some of the original materials that were submitted for the WGA, the credit dispute that came up. And it showed me that the manuscript was submitted as final draft under the title California Girls. But when I checked with Russ and Rich, it was back to Girls Gym when they were working on it. And it was Girls Gym when you went out to Hawaii, to New York and saw the Ramones. But
I think it was Disco High.
Yeah, Roger wanted it to be called Disco High because of the success of TGIF, the Thank God It's Friday movie, and Car Wash. Yeah. Right. I'm sorry for misspeaking, but then it was Disco Girls, but you were concealing that name at that point from your bands because people like Todd Rundgren had sort of sniffed at the idea of being something.
There was another draft of the script. Yeah. There was a draft of the script that we sent out to the bands and to people that needed it that said Rock and Roll High School. And the Disco High script was the one that Roger's office had. And I think it's the one also that when we went around for locations was a muted version. There was yet another version that didn't have the school blowing up and stuff like that.
Okay.
That was just used to con teachers and principals.
Well, and one thing that I think is interesting about California Girls, it's this element of the story, of course, that's the famous Beach Boys song. And brought, you know, a lot of the attention of the music in the film is given to the Ramones and some to the Nick Lowe and then some to the old sort of chestnut songs like High School by MC5 and the Chuck Berry School Days, so on and so forth. But Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys creep through that movie with the Joey wrote the song, the title song, and it's a car song in many ways, and it has the same structure. Of course, that's what the Beach Boys were doing in the beginning when they weren't writing about surfers; they were writing car songs. And and the Paley Brothers, who were a power pop band of Lower East Side, they weren't punk, but they were in that group back then. Well, they were Beach Boys fanatics. And Andy Paley would eventually go on and do some really wonderful work with Brian Wilson solo. So you have, it's a Corman film in the sense that it's a New World picture. It's a cheap, cheap, cheap sort of thing. But we're always talking about the Ramones, as I said, but also the influences of international cinema. But right there under everybody's nose too is the Beach Boys sort of nibbling at the whole thing. I don't know if it was intended or not.
Well, the arc for me about the Ramones was I would buy any record that Robert Christgau gave an A to in the Village Voice because I had been following his stuff and it was like a great way. So I bought the first Ramones record because he gave it an A. And I remember playing it and not getting it at all, right? And then one night, Joe and everyone comes over and they say, oh, what do you got that's new? And so I said, oh, you guys are not going to believe this. This band is all the rage in New York and every song sounds alike. Listen to this. So I stood at the record player and I went, drop the needle. We heard about 20 seconds, drop the needle. And after a while, we were all laughing so hard. And then it dawned on me that I had not gotten the joke, right? That it was supposed to be that way. So then I liked the record. And then when I read Christgau's review, and he was of the second record, and it was Lobotomy, and he wrote, apparently the Ramones are against DDT as well. So there's a message here. So I liked that record. And then when I heard Rocket to Russia, I knew greatness, you know. That's where I heard the Beach Boys connection, in that record mostly. And in discussions, mm-hmm. I've always felt that the Bramones sound like a girl group or the Beach Boys backed by chainsaws. And John's guitar is the chainsaw. So that's the yin and the yang of it all. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Do You Want to Dance is also in the soundtrack. And that had been picked up. The Beach Boys had done a version of that too with Dennis singing. And
right. And yeah. Is that on Road to Ruin, Mark?
I don't know what album it's on.
Yeah. Because the set list that I had given to them, the night they came over my house to see Hard Day's Night, we had a meeting. Monty was with them, and I think Danny Fields. And we had a meeting about the songs they would play in the movie. And they wanted to start with "Hey Ho, Let's Go." Whatever I wanted to do was so they moved around the set, and then I wanted to do "California Sun," and they said, "Well, we don't. That's not a thing." And I said, "Well, it's really good for the chase scenes. This is where it'll fall." Mm-hmm. So we went through that, and they didn't want to do "She's the One," and I said, "No, because you're going to sing it to riff, and so the narrative aspects of it." And we filmed them doing "I Want to Be Sedated," and it never made it in the movie. And then Roger threw out all the negatives. So, ugh. I know. Listen,
that's a heartbreaker. That's a heartbreaker.
And the fact that it's lost is right up there with the missing reels of Lost Horizon and Magnificent Ambersons.
I mean,
not to mention Greed. So.
I mean, they should talk. You talk about it, I'm sure, in your classes. Like that, yeah. this is a travesty. I want to bring up another quote that Mark said in another one of Stephen's book, Volume 2 of New World Pictures and Oral History. You said the atmosphere at New World was, if you want to do it, do it.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
And could you guys expound on that? I just thought that was fascinating.
Well, in the editing room, for instance, Kent and I wanted to edit. Assistants usually don't edit. They provide all the bins and or rolls of film for the editor to edit, but they don't usually get to actually edit. But we wanted to cut something, so we asked, "Can we cut the trailer?" And Alan said, "Yeah, go do it." And so Kent and I cut the trailer. And that's the trailer that went out.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to do it and we were able to do it. And so we did it.
Yeah.
And same thing during production, anything that you wanted to do, if it needed to be done and you could do it, you were supposed to just pitch in and do it. I remember when we were spray painting the walls of the high school.
Right.
Alan was spray painting the walls and he said, grab some paint, start spraying. So I started spraying words up on the wall. It was fantastic. It was moving all the time. There was never a moment where you rested because there was always something to do. I was rearranging parked cars and moving the set around. Anything that needed to be done, you did. And I recently remembered, because of this lost Super 8 footage that Larry Bach had shot during the pickup shots of Rock and Roll High School, that I was the script supervisor for that and boom operator. So I was doing all kinds of things on my first movie. And it's because it was a Roger Corman production, because everybody pitched in and did everything.
Right. And that way, there were people who felt too privileged and walked away. I'm not going to stand out there in the street and direct traffic. Well, okay.
Miller Drake just sent me a statement saying that there was no better film school ever than working at New World Pictures.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
I learned more in one day or 1 week on the set there than 4 years of film school, for sure.
Certainly in the editing room, because that's where Roger would come all the time. That's where you really got the education, because he would show up to, you'd go to see the films and he would take notes in the back. And then, and the film was over, we would sit there and he would talk to the filmmakers, the director, about what wanted to be changed and so forth. And then I'll meet you in the editing room the day after tomorrow. And then he would sit with me and Joe and John and talk about what we would sell. And then once the director and it was gone, he would ask us our opinions, you know, and that was kind of the process. So we were in on a lot of stuff that happened and in a kind of creative position. And then we go and cut the trailer. I cut music, you know, there was no editors, no post department. There was no music editors. And I would fire all the editors except for the head editor when you started mixing. So there was nobody even to carry the boxes to the mix, right?
Oh, I have a story about that.
Please.
Rock and Roll High School had a 2-day mix for the entire feature.
Yeah.
At Writer Sound. So I was still the assistant. So I was the guy carrying the reels and the boxes to the mix. And I was there during the first day of the mix in the mixing room. And Roger came in and he was watching, supervising the part of the mix. And he leaned over to Mike Pinnell and pointed to me and he said, "No, what is his job?" And he said, "Oh, that he's the assistant editor." He goes, "Well, the film is cut. I don't think that you need to be paying for an assistant at this point." And so
one day.
And so there was one more day left in the mix. And Mike came over to me on that first day and he said, "Mark, you can show up tomorrow, but today has to be your last paid day." So
I was going to ask what it was like to be fired by Roger Corman, but I guess we just discovered what that was like.
It's fine. I'm glad I saved him $20.
Listen, we had the first summer, Joe and I worked so hard in the summer of 74, right? All these pictures, we were just learning our job and all of this. And towards the end of the summer, Roger's in the editing room and he says, "You boys have done a great job, you know, and I think we're out of pictures, you know, to do. So why don't you take 3 weeks off and I'll rehire you when you come back." We had been there 24/7. So the following year, we're thinking, we don't want to go through that again, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons we were pushing to direct the movie so we wouldn't get fired.
But Mark, you could have had a job at McDonald's, right?
I knew how to make burgers thanks to
that wonderful story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a day we were shooting at a school and they had ordered McDonald's or some, I think it was McDonald's, for the whole crew and the cast. And I was to go and pick up 100 burgers and fries and bring them right back to the set by 2:00, or else we'll go into meal penalty. That's what Mike told me. We want to avoid meal penalty. I didn't even know what meal penalty was. It sounded really bad. So I went to the McDonald's and they had not started the order yet. I said, "I'm here to pick up the 100 burgers." "Oh, we haven't started. We're short staffed." And I said, "I need them. I have to avoid meal penalty. I need them like within 5 minutes." They said, "Well, can you come help us?" So I jumped over the counter and I was flinging burgers and helping them make these 100 burgers. I shoved them into my van and I hit the gas and I'm arriving with seconds to spare. And right there at the gate is Mike Fennell with his hands outstretched and he says, "Give me 2 burgers. I gave him 2 burgers and he started running to shove them into the hands of the cast so he would avoid the meal penalty.
But you avoided the meal penalty. That's you know.
And so at one time we were shooting Grand Theft Auto and Mike was the second unit production manager. And that movie had the tightest shot list. It took us 2 days to do the production meeting. Can you believe that? We had to go over every shot because we couldn't afford doubles on the costumes. So the costumes had to be in certain places. And even though there were stuntmen, and questions came up like Jane Rum once asked, "Will we see their feet in the helicopter?" Which was one of my favorite notes because she only had one pair of shoes. And I said, just from the bottom so we could fake it. And so we had all this stuff already laid out where we would be, and because we had to keep intersecting with Ron's first unit to do the massive scenes, and then we'd go off in different directions. And we're going to shoot a scene after lunch, and there was a choice of these drive-bys or this very fancy shot. And the shot was, God, this is an homage to a Russian movie called When the Cranes Are Flying. So I had this idea that the car would go underneath the camera and we'd flip the camera and it would disappear down the road because I'd seen it in this movie in film school. And so Mike is going, no, no, let's save that. No, no, you know, we got to get the meat, you know. And so we went off and did it, at, you know, we're there. And Mike shows up at the other place in the Winnebago, you know. And we're setting this up and all of a sudden we see on the horizon this Winnebago coming really fast. And you can see Mike through the windshield. And we had been in the desert now for like a week. So everyone is like half mad with, you know. And the door, the thing starts to slow down, but it's been doing 65, so maybe it's 35. And the door opens and Mike can't wait to get out. He steps out of the Winnebago and goes off the road, goes end over end. And we go running up, and he's like half conscious, goes, this is the wrong order. You shouldn't be shooting this now. And so we'll put you in the Winnebago. We'll get the shot. And I swear to God, Mike, we're going to the next location.
He took his job seriously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one time, and that same shoot, we had this big car thing to do. And we were doing something in the morning with Rance Howard. And now we had to drive, and we're constantly checking to make sure that we had the right cars with us, and we're headed to the different locations. This was so carefully laid out. And all of a sudden, I look in the rearview mirror, and I see that the major car in the next location, the black van, is missing, not in the row of cars. And I start going, where's the black van? Where's the black van? We got to stop. Where's the black van? And Mike Cassidy just goes, you're in the black van. So that was kind of the obsession of the whole thing, you know?
to skip to another New World adjacent movie, I wanted to bring up Get Crazy. Which had a lot of New World people working on it.
Yes.
And I was wondering, was it easier to get this movie going because of Rock and Roll High School?
Yes. Yes. I would say that I got a lot of meetings off of Rock and Roll High School, and some of them were really fun. Like I had a meeting with Walter Mirisch, and that was really cool. Wow. I mean, sitting there and he's got all these Oscars and he's got posters everywhere and, you know, Billy Wilder posters, and right behind his desk was this big poster for Fiddler on the Roof. And I kept telling him how much I loved it and so forth. But then I took this picture called Heartbeeps, and I made the wrong movie, just to cut to the chase. I literally made the wrong movie. And the reason they hired me was not the movie I delivered. And basically then I was fired off the movie and they finished editing without me. Mm. And then it came out and it got terrible, terrible reviews. And so I wanted to return to something that I knew about, and that's why I Get Crazy. So that's when I went to Danny Opatashu, who we worked with, and said, you know those times we sat at the Fillmore and said, this would make a great movie? Let's do that. So that's how Get Crazy got written, because I felt it was on firmer ground, you know. And so when the movie came out and then got buried, there wasn't very much reaction to it. And there were some okay reviews. But then 37 years later, when it came out again 2 years ago, by then Rock and Roll High School had done what it did, which is permeate a certain aspect of people seeing it and so forth. So all the reviews, which when it came out, would not have done this. All the reviews referenced Rock and Roll High School and saw it as a continuity that it was.
Right.
And saw that this was something that I was doing on purpose, this style, you know, and all of that. So I ended up getting really great reviews on the Get Crazy Blu-ray because people related it to Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah. I didn't go to the Fillmore East, but I went to college in San Francisco, and I went to the Fillmore West there. It was out there.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw just about every band that I could see there. I absolutely love that venue. But apparently it had a much cleaner bathroom. So the one in the West and the East. So because I didn't experience
I'm happy to say that in the new version, in the Blu-ray, I was able to color correct the lighting in the bathroom to my satisfaction. Because we had a foot of water, we couldn't run cable. So we had only one light from the top, and it looked too bright to me. So I brought the light down and I made it greenish so that would really look like a sickly bathroom in a theater.
Oh, it's such a great scene.
It's not like the equal of Blade Runner, or you know, Ridley Scott going back.
I don't know.
The bathroom light is better. You know,
that's another film with the absolutely wonderful soundtrack album to accompany it. And I had found that tape in I must have been in 10th grade or so in the remainder bin at a Kent Mill Records outside of Washington D.C. Loved Lou Reed, still do, and one of his most beautiful songs is on that movie, and it's such an anarchic, crazy, crazy movie, and of subdued, beautiful music coming from Lou Reed. I've told Alan that a dozen times, but Alan's name has been in my head since I was, you know, in early in high school, and Alan Arkush makes movies with great music, with great soundtracks. And
thank you.
That introduced me to Sparks, and I knew that there was a Howard Kalin Beyond the Turtles and all that, and just always adored that record and the whole fabulous ending with Auld Lang Syne and so forth. And
I think it has Lou Reed's finest comic acting.
Yes, definitely.
Better than One Trick Pony.
Did he make up all those songs on the spot? Was he, or did he have
pretty much? You know,
it's fantastic, so great.
Yeah,
that was the year when he was doing Blue Mask and yes, Street Hassle,
and that's that how I got when... the job. That's how I talked them into it. Was talking to him about the Blue Mask, how much I loved it. I thought it was a great album.
Yeah,
and so he thought I was serious because I didn't. Yeah,
yeah.
But actually, go ahead.
Street Hassle. No, it's more like it's the return to RCA with the Blue Mask and Legendary Hearts and New Sensations. And then he did a terrible record called Mistrial. But there's that song Little Sister in there. It's like Danforth Girl or something from Dylan. It's just a perfect song, a story song. Oh, I used to listen to that. I told you when I was this punk rocker in high school. I was having trouble with my grades, but I was also having trouble with my dad really kind of yelling at me all the time. And I would get punished by having to clean the garage. And I just remember playing Rock and Roll Animal over and over and the soundtrack to Get Crazy over and over. It was sort of a great my resistance. Record. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we're doing Get Crazy Blu-ray, they had sent me a memo, MGM, that said that, because I had sent a memo about music rights, and they said, no, you can't have any music in the movie, in the extras. And I said, why? And they said, we don't allow music and so forth, and your paperwork is incomplete because it had been lost over the years, and we don't know who was responsible for what on the record. So you can use Auld Lang Syne, and that's it. And then I said, you know it's a musical, right? Right. And there was silence. Just... They had not watched the movie. They didn't know it was wall-to-wall music.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you have to figure this out yourself. You know, they assigned me a lawyer who worked for like an hour on it and said, I can't find who owns what music and who wrote what, and there's no paperwork. So I hung up and I walked over to my record cabinets and I took out my soundtrack album and opened it up, and there was everyone's name on the label. It was that much research. And then I got on Facebook And I said, does anybody know, remember this movie, and where I can find the producer and the guy who wrote Hot Shot and everything? And I get a phone call. I get a post literally 3 hours later says, oh, the producer's my dad. And the guy who wrote Hot Shot comes over the house all the time, plays poker with my dad. And here's their phone number. And I had everybody's name within 3 hours.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm so glad, because it's such a great release.
They fought us tooth and nail till it was finally done. And we just ended up lying about getting people permission. You know, it's just...
Well, I'm glad
there's so many great extras on that Blu-ray.
And
there are some extras that didn't make it to the Blu-ray, which are on YouTube as well.
Our documentary about that you and I and Kent did about the theater, the Will Turn and
Rock and Roll Saved My Life. All about how
everyone talking about their first rock concert. And I'm going to give way. So I'm talking to Malcolm about the first concerts he went to and everything and his music. And so I said, well, you know, you're from Northern England. Did you ever see the band called The Fabs? You know, that's the Beatle name for themselves. Yeah. And he goes, not only did I see them, I saw them when they were the Silver Beatles, which is so cool, because Mark was like 2 weeks they were called the Silver Beatles.
yeah, not long.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. He's so good in the movie. Oh, my God. It's such a great ode to music, and so is Rock and Roll High School. And then you made another movie, which Mark, you also worked on, Shake, Rattle, and Rock.
Yeah, I edited that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, no assistant, no getting cut for a day.
No, we had all of like 5 days to edit it, though.
I mean, wasn't that fast?
Something like that. I mean, it was 2 weeks to shoot, and then we had to deliver it like a week later or something like that.
Yeah,
that was
the deal. You could make any movie you wanted as long as it didn't cost more than $1.4 million, which I think on the case of this was like 10 days of shooting. And it had to have the same title and most of the same script. So the script for Shake, Rattle, and Rock was inspired by the 50s movie Shake, Rattle, and Rock, which had also inspired Rock and Roll High School. So it was a conscious attempt to keep that lineage going.
Yeah. Speaking of Rock and Roll High School, when it came out, it played with a couple different movies. I was wondering, Alan, if you could tell me which one it played better with. The Kids Are All Right, Avalanche, or Dawn of the Dead?
Well, I'm prejudiced because we died in Texas and New Mexico. Then we played in San Francisco, and I don't remember, but by then the word was out and Frank Moreno could give a shit. And so we played with a different movie in each area. There was no thought given to it.
Okay.
But dates opened up in Chicago. And the distributor of Corman in Chicago was really good, because he would, whenever we gave him a trailer, he played it early and he did a great job. And he got he found two openings. So it opened in Chicago opposite with Dawn of the Dead and Grease. And in every theater, it did great. So he understood the movie. Hmm. And that's when Siskel and Ebert reviewed it. And then in their review, they said you should go to Midnight. So when we finished our 2 weeks there, we went to Midnight. So I'm prejudiced towards Dawn of the Dead, although The Kids Are All Right and Rock and Roll High School is a damn fine double bill. And Jeff Stein is a cool guy who did the movie. And I have my copy of The Kids Are All Right. And
the Ramones loved The Kids Are All Right.
Yes.
We had a screening with them. We were just talking about this the other night, that we were there with the Ramones and you and me and Kent watching the movie at some lab.
Yeah.
I forgot.
And because I had a little bit of heat after Rock and Roll High School, Fox invited me to a screening, a cast and crew and Hollywood, you know, big deal, of Alien. And the Ramones were in town, and I said, can I bring four guests, you know, or five guests, because Monty had to be with them. So they said, who is it? And I said, it's a band from New York called the Ramones. So Joanne and I are sitting in this place, and it's full of like Hollywood people, because the word was out that Alien was going to be great. And we had a row of ticket seats, and they're like, everyone's going, who could that be? And in walked the Ramones, totally Ramones, you know, the leather jackets. And it was like aliens from another planet, you know. And you can't walk down the street in the Lower East Side without being treated like they are gods. And here they are coming in. And it was such a great moment, you know, to have them, you know, the world is full of hierarchies, you know. And it was just great. And they loved the movie. It was the perfect movie for John. You know, they were more horror movie fans than anyone else. But it was certainly made me laugh, you know.
And John was a huge movie fan, right? He had a huge collection. Yes.
And when the Ramones were watching the dailies of them arriving at the high school, and Dee Dee said, "We look like we're from another planet." And I said, "Exactly." Exactly.
That's why you wanted to have the Ramones, right? Because they would look so different.
That was certainly one of the reasons, because the basic humor was there of her saying that she loved Joey, you know.
Well, this has been awesome, guys. Thank you so much. I love this book. This is terrific. I love the movie.
It's a great book.
It's been amazing to talk with you guys. Steven, you know, I'm sure you're already working on another New World book, but I have to ask, why is it about CoverGirl models?
Why isn't it? Oh, man.
Try and find it. I mean, I have a print of it, but someone found the trailer, which is what, you know, it's the best part of the movie.
Right, right. Well, and that's where you guys found that helicopter explosion that you guys would put into every trailer after that.
Right, and there's a little film out there on my Facebook page that someone made, that we made with someone else, that explains all that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on that, and it's on my YouTube page, A History of the Editing Room. But I do want to say about Steven's book, as much as I like all of it, the part of it that I most cherish is the stuff about the editing room. Wouldn't you agree, Mark? He really captured.
I think, he captured not only the editing room, but the production day by day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I haven't seen anything like that since, you know, the Beatles recording. books.
It's very kind of you.
It's very great.
It's incredibly thorough. And as somebody who has done a podcast about New World Pictures for almost 5 years, it's fascinating for that very reason, Alan, to talk about like where you guys were, where you were situated, where the buildings were, like, how the editing room looked, like all that stuff, especially to me, was just absolutely fascinating.
Oh, and it brings me back to read the editing room stuff, because that was really five, six years of my life, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, when Joe and I got together to do this, our little film about the editing room, we were wondering what else we did to our time. So I added up all the movies that we saw, because I keep track of what I've seen. And from 1974 to 79, we saw 1,900 movies.
Wow.
I think it was 1,906, you know. Well, over 6 years. Yeah.
In 6 years. Wow.
Yeah. In 6 years.
Well, thank you guys so much. I could talk to you guys all day, but yes. Go ahead, Steven. I'm sorry.
Only that I wanted to thank Alan and Mark too, because when I was going through this task of doing the book, I had to kind of compete against this excellent movie that Daniel Griffith put together, which appears in the special 40th edition of the Rock and Roll High School, the Blu-ray edition.
Yeah.
And got to talking to Mark, thanks to Joe, and Alan through Joe. Mark sent me materials with call sheets, and they're the most valuable thing practically for a film historian to work with. A copy of the script and the promotional materials and all that. And then, so that was an enormous resource. And I would talk to Mark now and then through Zoom, and it was helpful, enormously helpful. Then Alan and I developed this relationship, this working relationship, where I could get into the minutia and send him an email trying to pinpoint a date or even a city block. And he was so
I got to tell you, Stephen, my favorite is you called me and you sent me an email and said, when you went to New York to see the Ramones for the first time, how did you get from the airport to the West Village where your parents lived? And then, and so you were at your parents' house, Was there a bedroom? I said, no, I slept on the couch. Okay, got it. Got it.
But and that's the, and it's in the
book.
Ways, the
it's in the book.
Yeah, but that's when Joe was telling me about the making of Piranha, and scenes were not adequately motivated when he had the first script. And then Francis brought in John Sayles, and it was motivation, precision, pinpointing. Yeah. And you know, I've been very much influenced by my historical work with these wonderful, wonderful people. And if I ever do another book from scratch on a story, it would probably be with that group, that sort of Paul Bartel to Amy Jones. There's something about that window where Mark and Alan and Joe and Hunt Lowry and all those people fall in. It was just a magnificent period. And I've semi-jokingly told people that the Nouvelle Vague of America was late 70s New World Pictures at Jack Rabin and Associates. And but I know it's the end of your show. I could talk about this all day, too. And it's just been
no, and I could, too. I just want to be sensitive to time. And I want to thank you guys for your time. This has been an awesome, absolute thrill for me, seriously, just to talk with you guys, to meet you guys, to meet Steven, to read this book. And I will say, since I asked you guys to start, my first A New World movie was Rock and Roll High School.
Oh my God. Great.
Yay.
That's nice.
So
good times.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Mark, Alan, Stephen. Okay. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Ryan.
And that's it. That's our interview with Alan Arkish, Mark Helfrick, and author of I Want You Around, The Ramones and the Making of Rock and Roll High School. Stephen B. Armstrong, make sure you pick up this book. It's excellent, and I can't say enough good things about it. It's very, very good. Of course, Alan Arkish and Mark had some very nice things to say about it as well. But
good job, Ryan. Hey, it's Erica.
Hey,
I don't know if you still wanted me. If you still wanted me around, audio wink. But just wanted to say good job on that. Good job, Dome.
I want you both around. It's weird to have done it by myself. No, no
I
doubt.
Don't think you sounded nervous at all. I think you sounded great.
That's great. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate that.
And lucky us. Probably the less of me, the more interviews we will get. So keep it up, Ryan.
That's not true. Come on, guys. In fact, if you want to listen to more of our interviews and more of our episodes about movies released by New World Pictures, go to our website, www.newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find out all of our information. You can buy a t-shirt, which would help us out, or you can go ahead and give us a 5-star review on any of the places where you listen to podcasts. That would also help us out, too. Otherwise, stay tuned for more ha-ha-gist content, and we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody!
If you're looking for more horror outside of the mainstream, look no further than Unsung Horrors, a podcast about underseen horror movies. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica. Every other week, we'll cover a horror movie with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. We'll even give you double feature recommendations to pair with the movies we discuss.
From gothic to shot on video, from slashers to comedies, from giallo to J-horror, we'll cover all the subgenres. So join us as we unearth these hidden gems of horror.
Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors, available wherever you listen to podcasts. And part of the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.